to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. You are listening to Louis Moroni and my partner Jim Vernon, and we are here talking to Robert Massoud. Robert is a Palestinian Canadian. He was schooled in Montreal and graduated from University College, University of Toronto in political economy. And he has consulted independently in business strategy, communication, and marketing technology. And he is the founder of Beit Zaytoun, which is a cultural center, gallery, and community meeting space in downtown Toronto that promotes the interplay of art, culture, and politics to explore issues of social justice and human rights, both locally and internationally. So welcome, Robert.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Maybe you could start off by telling us a little bit about the process that led you to open Beit Zaytoun.
Well, Beit Zaytoun actually is phase two of a larger project. It started really with an organization called Zaytoun. And Zaytoun is the Arabic word for olive. And 10 years ago, I wanted to become active on the question of justice and peace in Palestine. And I was looking for a different way of becoming engaged. I really wasn't interested in politics or political advocacy. I wasn't interested in doing media work as such. I wanted to touch people in a different way. I wanted to touch them at the level of heart and soul, not at the level of words or images, because I just feel that words and images can be manipulated, cause confusion, and people just give up and walk away. And in looking for how could I reach Canadians, North Americans with the essence of Palestine and the essence of the Palestinian sort of challenge and the problem, the olive oil came to me as a way to bring a piece of Palestine to North America and get people to connect through the olive oil to the larger question. And the olive oil is the universal symbol for peace. So in a way, it's just made for this purpose because it draws people to that focus point. It's about peace. It's a symbol of peace. And the olive tree has been adopted by the Palestinian people as their symbol and their attachment to the land. The olive tree is ubiquitous. It's everywhere in the landscape of Palestine. It's what you see when you look out in the horizon. And it's a tree that is extremely hardy. It's resistant to wind. It's resistant to drought. And it's also called the eternal tree. And so for all these reasons, it just spoke to me as the thing that I needed to do. And so in 2003, I was looking around, I imported a small batch of olive oil, bottled it, put a very nice label, told a story, which is really what we want to do. I mean, it's not about selling olive oil. It's really about how can you work with the olive oil to tell a story of the people of Palestine and what they faced in the last 100 years. Because ultimately, for me, and I would say for every Palestinian, it's always a question of voice. Where is your voice and how can you get your voice heard in an environment, in a Western world that really, in a way, it's not just that they don't want to hear your voice, they just want to also drown out your voice. And they drown it out through misrepresentation, misinformation, disinformation, and denial and ridicule. So the olive oil for me was a way to cut through all of that. And after an initial offering of only 1,500 bottles, and I thought it was the only thing I would do, and I'd pack my bags and go home, there was such an incredible outburst or feeling from people that they wanted more and more, and they wanted this to continue. So here we are almost 10 years later, and the oil is still doing its thing. And so that was the first level of engagement in building a bridge from Palestine to North America.
How deep are your roots in Palestine?
Personally, for me, I mean, I came to Canada as a child, and I've grown up in Canada from the age of six. I've been schooled in Western philosophy and media. So I'm thoroughly engaged and connected with a Western sort of mindset and approach. But at the same time, you know, I can't help but feel not so much for Palestine as Palestine only, but for the larger question of justice, global justice. And for me, Palestine, in a way, is the poster child of injustice in the world, because it's the one that stares you in the face and says, I dare you to do anything. It's there in the media relentlessly every day. Everybody talks about it. Every, you know, politician says they're going to do something about it or deals with it, and nothing happens. So to me, it holds the key to any sort of justice or peace in the world. Because if it doesn't happen in Palestine, I don't think it'll happen elsewhere. Because Palestine is, in a way, the one that has the cause, the issue that has made accomplices of the United Nations, of the United States, the European Union, and now, of course, even Canada to the greatest degree, for injustice, for the avoidance of international law, for the mockery of it. So if we're not going to make it stick on Palestine, it's just not going to happen. Because at the end of the day, every tin pot dictator will say, well, you know, if Israel can do it, why can't I? If Israel can get away with it, if international law does not apply to Israeli policy, why should it apply to me? So you got to start somewhere.
And that's interesting. You essentially, your impetus for starting Zatoun was really a desire to express or to help justice in general.
Absolutely.
And,
yeah.
And Palestine was the glaring subject for you. Yeah. You're Palestinian Canadian, so that actually obviously helps. Mm-hmm. How did this lead to Beit Zatoun?
Well, that's exactly what you're saying is that, you know, Zatoun really spoke on one dimension to one geographic kind of situation, and Zatoun was the way in, and it was in my mind to find a home for Zatoun eventually. And so 5-6 years into Zatoun, it gave birth to Beit Zatoun. And Beit in Arabic means home or house. So it's House of Olive. And Beit Zatoun is different than Zatoun in that Zatoun has a worldwide reach, or at least continent-wide reach. We sell in Canada and the United States virtually through the internet and word of mouth and so on. But through a very limited dimension of offering, being the olive oil, Za'atar, which is a herb mix, which is very lovely, and people really, once they taste it, they love it, incidentally, and soap. And these are all symbolic Palestinian products that connect people to Palestine. But Beit Zatoun is different in that it exists at a point in place. It exists here in downtown Toronto on Markham Street opposite Honest Ed's. But it has this incredible offering. It can offer a multiple channels of engagement. So it's the art, it's the culture, and it also then invites and is inclusive across different causes and subjects. So, for instance, it's about justice, but it's not just about political justice. It's about environmental justice. It's social justice, economic justice, political, gender justice, racial justice. So all of these facets of justice have a place here in all the various communities in Toronto that experience their form of injustice across, you know, whatever spectrum they experience it, have a home to bring it out. So really, Beit Zatoun is a meeting place around questions of justice, using art and culture as a way to express and to resist. And all I can say is it works. We are here, you know, 3 years later. We've had over 360 events. And these have been events across all kinds of art forms. So from film to music to plays, photo exhibits, painting, 3D dimension or 3D installations, of course, your regular talks and workshops and symposia. And these have been from communities as wide ranging as, you know, Filipino, South African, North African, of course, Middle Eastern, Iranian, Latin American, Caribbean, First Nations, LGBT, So for us, this is a home where all can come to meet to gain mutual recognition and awareness of their I wouldn't call it issue, but their particular challenge around what faces them in an unjust scenario or configuration. And that's where you can build solidarity. Because I honestly believe that any single community or on single issue can't really get anywhere. It's only through solidarity and mutual cooperation. So Beit Zetun, from a Palestinian perspective or looking at that problem, was the Palestinians aren't going to go anywhere without friends. You know, it's just not going to happen. If Palestine is going to achieve any level of justice or peace or recognition, it can only be through solidarity in other communities. So by its very nature, Beit Zetun has to be inclusive, it has to be inviting, and it has to offer everyone an equal platform. So we're non-aligned, we're independent, we're secular. So for us, it's very important that we maintain our independence. We do not receive grants of any kind. We're not interested in applying for grants. We are interested in maintaining the maximum level of independence. And that's why we're completely volunteer run. We keep our costs down to the minimum. So that increases our ability to just maintain our independence and survive without the need for any kind of government grants or any agency grants. Because we believe that grants just really, in a way, take away from organizations because they take so much time to apply for and then maintain and monitor and then renew.
And they often come with
conditions and so on. Like often, like to tell you, I mean, certain communities come to Beit Zetun because they can't have their conversation or their presentation the way they want it in their community centers because they're politicizing the center, and it's a community center. So in a way, what that does is it really stifles dissent, it stifles resistance, it stifles communication. And again, I believe as a free country, quotation marks, you know, with free speech and so on, you know, that's just, you can't do that.
Well,
we have to be free.
In a way, I mean, what you're saying is there really shouldn't be a line between community and politics. It's really one and the same.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that's one of the great losses, the real crimes of our particular societies. We've become so compartmentalized. It's like there's culture here, there's economy here, there's politics here, and they're just sort of unique silos, miles apart from each other, and they have nothing to do with each other. Where I think, hell, they've got everything to do with each other. And in a way, Beit Zetun is the place where they come and meet, both at a local level and a global level.
Go ahead, Jim.
Just maybe you could tell us a little bit then about the challenges in organizing a space which is anomalous in the political landscape. And
yeah.
So we're fairly used to hearing about support for NGOs, which is, we've intimated, has a kind of limiting effect on what can be done given the NGO mandate. Opening up a space which is that inclusive, but also that committed. Can you talk about the challenges of holding those two things together?
Yeah. Well, the challenges are really one of keeping the place going. It's not that, you know, we're not having trouble meeting the rent. We're meeting the rent, but it's the challenges are, how do you bring in more volunteers and volunteers with very specific skills and have them really commit those skills for a long period of time? So we're completely volunteer run, and you know, our volunteers come. Oftentimes they're either students or they're graduates. They have limited time in Toronto before they leave, or they're between jobs and such. And so once they get, you know, involved in something else, we lose them. The challenge is to run a place professionally, at least as professionally as you really want it to be. Because I think it's important that what you put out there needs to be not just have great value, but also show great professionalism and quality. And I think we've done that, and I think we need to continue doing that. We can also do a much better job. So for one example, for instance, is social media. You know, we need to do a better job on social media. Personally, you know, it's my weakness. You know, I have many strengths, but I also have weaknesses. And social media is a weakness. And on my own, I really couldn't, I can't devote the amount of time and so on to it. And I'm just looking for a social media champion, for instance. So an organization such as this one, it really needs a series of champions. It needs kind of a programming champion. It needs a communication outreach champion. It needs a fundraising champion. It needs a social media champion. People who will take on, you know, those particular tasks with a real degree, not just of commitment, but expertise and experience, and bring it all together. And that's when a place like Beit Zetun can really, you know, go to the next level. Because right now, you know, as I said, we're meeting the rent, but we can't afford to pay speakers. We can't afford to bring people in. And it would be nice to do that. I mean, we've been very, very fortunate in that people like Beit Zetun. They love Beit Zetun, and they're happy to play here. I mean, you wouldn't believe the concerts we've had and the performances. And it would be not when usually we give them a bottle of olive oil, and that's their honorarium, and they're happy with it. But at the same time, I'd like to be able to pay them an amount. You know, not a huge amount, because we're not professional in that way, but just to recognize their parking, their babysitting, and so on. And so we need to go to the next level of running the place, which is to professionalize it to a certain extent. You know, have perhaps a part-time employee, and then have dedicated, specific sort of functionality expertise, social media being a big one. Because I think, you know, definitely social media is where it's at right now in terms of communication, particularly in this way of reaching out, particularly to younger people. And so you got to, you know, create a presence, and you got to create engagement and interaction through social media. Right now, you know, most of our social media is kind of one way. There's so much more opportunity to have a two-way kind of interaction with much more activity. So that's an opportunity and a challenge that we definitely want to meet.
So speaking about struggles and music, maybe you can introduce the first song choice you've provided for us and talk a little bit about it as way of introduction.
Yeah. Well, it's actually a song. It's a rap song, and it's from a group called Dam. And they're actually Palestinians living inside of Israel. And it's three guys. And the song is called Min Arhabi. And the translation of that is, who is the terrorist? And as you listen to the song, you can just really, without even understanding a single word, understand the need to get it out, and the sheer outrage of the perceived injustice of who are you calling the terrorist? Because when you listen to the words, and the words are basically challenging the various modes of suffering of the Palestinians at the hands of the Israeli occupation. Both in terms of, you know, the checkpoints and the brutality and the imprisonment and the killings and the home demolitions and the closures and just the cutting of olive trees and destruction of trees and the closure of lands. And, you know, one can go on almost endlessly with this. So that's what the song is about. And I think it's pretty easy to get what they're talking about, even if you don't understand the words.
مين إرهابي أنا إرهابي كيف إرهابي وأنا عايش ببلادي مين إرهابي أنت إرهابي ماكلني وأنا عايش ببلادي قتلني زي ما تلت إجدادي أجل القانون عن فاضي ما أنت يا عدو بتلعب دور الشاهد المحامي والقاضي علي قاضي نهايتي بادي حلمك انقل فوق معنى آلية حلمك لآلية تصير بالمقابر أكترية ديمقراطية والله انكم ناسية من كثر ما اغتصبتوا النفس العربية حبلت ولدت ولد اسمه عملية انفجارية وهنا ديتنا ارهابية يعني ضربتني وبكيت بديت سبعتني واشتكيت لما ذكرتك انك بديت نطيت وحكيت ما انتو بتخلوا ولاد صغار المحجار ما لهمش اهل يدبوهم بالدار ايش كنو نسيت انو استحق ضب الاهل تحت الحجار وعلى لما وجع الفار بتناديني ارهابي مين ارهابي انا ارهابي كيف ارهابي وانا عايش في بلادي مين ارهابي انت ارهابي ماكلني وانا عايش في بلادي ليش ارهابي عشان دمي مش هادي حامي عشان رافع راسي وارض بلادي قتلوا حبايبي انا لحالي اهلي تشردوا راح اضلي انادي انا مش ضد السلام السلام ضدي علي بده يدي طراسي بده يمحي واللي بيحكي كلمة بشد ورا همة بيكون زلمة تعملوا منه رمة ومين انتو لسه امتى خبرتو اطلعوا قديش قتلتو قديش قدمتو امياتنا بيبكوا ابياتنا بيشكوا اراضينا بيخطفوا انا بقولكم مين انتو انتو كبرتو بدلا احنا كبرنا فقر مين كبر بوسع ومين كبر بجحر صار في داعي عملتو منه اجرامي وانت يا ارهابي بتناديني ارهابي مين ارهابي انا ارهابي كيف ارهابي وانا عايش ببلادي مين ارهابي انت ارهابي ماكلني وانا عايش ببلادي انت ببطل ارهابي لما تضربني كف واعطيك خد تاني كيف تتوقع مني اشكر لاداني تعرف ايش انت قولي كيف دكياني راكع ركبي وايدي مربطات عيون بالارض وجثث ذات تات بيوت مهدومه عائلات مشردات اطفال يتيمه حريه بكلبشات انت عمر انت قطر احنا بنقبر ما علينا بنصبر وجعنا بنسطر اهم شيء انك تحس بامان اتريح وسيب لنا الالام ما هو دمنا دمك لا حتى لا لما الكلب يموت في الرفق بالحيوان يعني دمنا ارخص من دم الكلاب لا دمي غالي راح ادافع حالي لو تناديني ارهابي مين 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 ارهابي انت ارهابي
Hello, that was Mean Their Hobby by Dam. You're listening to After the Collapse on RadioRegion.com. Louis Maroney and I are here again with Robert Massoud from Beit Zetun. Maybe we'll just come back in now by focusing on the broader issue of Palestinian activism or pro-Palestinian activism within Canada. In the last 5 or 6 years, maybe, there's been a decided shift in policy in Canada regarding the issue, and in the recent debate surrounding the UN vote on statehood or on state status, the observer status, the Canada was one of the key players in trying to block mainly a solidarity gesture. And so I'm wondering if you could talk about the challenges of having a center of social justice grounded in the Palestinian situation within a country that is taking a shift, arguably backwards, from the rest of the world.
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, because we don't receive grants and so on, we're very independent and non-aligned. That's not really an issue for us. I mean, it has been an issue for a number of organizations such as Canadian Arab Federation, such as Palestine House, such as Kairos, Rights and Democracy. These are four organizations that were defunded or in the course of the last 3 years by, you know, the Harper regime, the Harper government. And so they really felt the shift in policy. For ourselves, you know, it just, I guess, underlines the need for a place like Beit Zetun for people to be able to come together and to have this level of interaction, either over culture or art, and with politics as the interplay. Because I think to strictly have art in a silo and culture in a silo and politics in a silo just is not representative of human life. I think it just, that's bloody boring and not interesting at all. And I think we know that. I mean, the best art is always infused with a political edge. I mean, culture as well. So I think you can't get away from that. And the more we try to get away from that, the more we impoverish ourselves. So I think in an environment where things are basically suppressed and being stifled, we are impoverishing our ability to think and our ability to be with each other, our ability to have compassion and to understand. So it's very important for a place like Beit Zetun to be a place of dissent, a place of resistance, a place of exploration, of discovery, of meeting. And So it hasn't, I guess I'm trying to say is whatever the regime is in Ottawa is not making things easier or harder for us. What it is doing is it's showing that more than ever, there is a need for people to come together on these issues. And so, but going back to another impact of the regime sort of changes and the policy changes is that it has focused people more than ever on the need to stand up and to resist. So for instance, just to give you a very current example, the Idle No More movement. Like that is phenomenal, just as there was the Red Square movement in Quebec. So these are indications of things are really boiling in this country and they need to come to rise. So the Idle No More is so exactly for me in my interpretation similar if not identical in its origins as the Spring Awakening or the Arab Awakening that happened in 2011.
You do hear a lot of the message coming from Idle No More of they want to separate themselves from the
leadership. Yeah, exactly.
They want it to be grassroots and they want it to express many different voices. And I'm glad you brought that up because it really does seem to have an affinity with what you're trying to do here.
Absolutely. So Idle No More, as I said, comes from the same place as the Arab Spring in certain terms of motivation. It's people who say, I'm mad as hell, I'm not taking it anymore. They're tired of the abuse. They're tired of being suppressed. They're tired of being ignored, which is exactly the motivation behind the Arab Spring in all the various Arab countries. And incidentally, also very similar in its motivation to the Intifadas. The Intifadas were the Palestinian movements, the first one in 1987 and lasted about 3 to 4 or 5 years, depending on how you want to sort of look at it. And the second was in 2002 and lasting to 2000 to 2002. And in Arabic, Intifada means shaking off. So again, it's the same sentiment of waking up and shaking off your oppression, shaking off, you know, the what's holding you down. And so for me, it's really... I don't know if the word is wonderful, but that Idle No More is here. And First Nations people have woken up in this grassroots kind of way, in this youthful way, and saying, you know, we're not necessarily going to go with the chiefs. We're not going to go with the old system. We're not going to go with the Minister of Indian Affairs or whatever they're called right now. We're going to do this differently. And that's the key, is to do it differently and to do it outside the system, in a way. And that, you could say, is, again, the thinking behind the Arab Spring, the thinking behind the Intifada, and the thinking behind Beit Zitoun. Beit Zitoun is part of this unaligned, independent, different approach that says, you know, really, we want the grassroots. We want people meeting people. We want people talking to people. We want people taking action on their own and not necessarily needing the vehicles or channels or facilities of institutions or government.
How has your message and your approach interacted with or connected across to Palestine itself? In other words, organizations there that you may be connected with?
Well, it's, I mean, the way I look at Beit Zitoun and Zitoun, I mean, our task is in North America. Mm-hmm. So I don't personally try to nurture or bring about relationships necessarily with organizations. They happen naturally in the sense that there are people who are traveling, people who are coming to North America who speak here, and they're, of course, welcome. But what I'm trying to say is I really focus in North America. That's where the job is. That's where a lot of the energy and the time goes. The task is big enough on just one side of the ocean rather than trying to straddle two and trying to build up too many relationships just because it's time consuming. Mm-hmm. And in a way, when they're ready, they have somebody coming over, they'll contact us and we'll work on that. So for me, as I said, just keeping the eye, my eye on the ball here, which is building bridges and building networks within North America. And North America meaning, you know, the United States and Canada. There's a lot of amazing progress being done in the United States with the mainline churches. So for the Methodist Church and the Presbyterian Church in the United States, they've both passed resolutions to boycott Israeli settlement goods, as has the United Church here in Canada. All these three happened in a space of, you know, a few months from each other over the summer of 2012. And now, of course, they have to, you know, work themselves through their organizations and see how practically they can be implemented and what they're going to mean. You know, that we'll see. And hopefully, you know, Zetun, Beit Zetun will have a role to play.
In listening to you and talking to you, I get a feeling and a sense of sort of the, I don't want to say insidiousness, but it feels like that, culture and politics, the division we talked about, and how we can almost sleepily find ourselves in a situation where we are disconnected from each other. So you almost, to me, you feel a bit like a goaltender in keeping, you know, trying to keep safe the community politics union that is necessary to, in a sense, have the freedom that we need, both culturally and with each other. So thank you for that. Jim, did you have a follow-up question before we go on to the next song?
I was just going to ask a question on the building bridges aspect. When you were talking, leading up to the boycott of settlement goods, which is one of the more prominent news stories of the last year or so, one of the more dominant activist movements regarding the Palestinian issue is the BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions movement. And one critique of the broader BDS movement is that Chomsky, for example, has said this, that it seems to be a community breaker in some sense, that it may be too early for it, whereas targeted boycotts like the towards settlement goods seems like the early action, although the majority movement seems to be dedicated towards the overall BDS movement. I wonder if there's a challenge, just in general, of fielding that particular problematic, those who support the wider movement or not.
Well, like any movement, you know, I mean, there's different ways of cutting it. There's different approaches, different strategies. There's different organizations and people. And I think BDS is at the table and has done amazing work. And I want it to continue. I wish it well, of course. And there's many different approaches even within the BDS movement and different strategies. And so what you mentioned, Chomsky and so on. You know, to me, the important thing is not to create division. The way I approach things personally is it's a hell of a big problem. It needs everybody's help. And there's no just one way of doing it. So everybody's welcome to the table. Just bring, you know, join the party with your stuff, whatever it is, whatever your strategy is. So Beit Zetun has an approach. Zetun is a kind of a different approach. BDS a different approach. You know, there's just so many organizations, you know, approaching it in different ways. And I would never tell anybody, don't do this or don't do that. You know, what speaks to you as an effective method that you're committed to, that you can, you know, contribute to and bring to the table, by all means do it. So I think BDS is definitely here to stay. I think BDS is doing tremendous work. And so whether it's targeted or it's universal, you know, it'll develop. It'll develop in its own time with its own sort of forces at when it needs to happen. And BDS is, I mean, it's boycott, divestment, and sanctions. I mean, it's a pretty complicated, you know, mass of measures and actions that have so many facets. So it's not hard to understand where you can get stuck on any number of issues within the broader heading of BDS. I mean, you've got the academic BDS, you've got cultural, you know, institutional. So there's many aspects that people buy into that, but they don't buy into that part of it. You know, so that's fine. I mean, there'll always be those kinds of disagreements in any resistance, any sort of justice movements. I think the key is to accept them and to work with them, and not necessarily to try to undo them or to say, oh no, there's only one way of doing this. No, there's just, it's too big for any one way to be dominant, or one way to say, you know, we've got the truth here on this one.
You know, also going back to, you know, the difficulty of finding volunteers for things and people, you know, in these kinds of movements, all of the energy expended is voluntary. And so even just to have anybody expend any time, any kind of energy, I find it, or you might think that it's not worth discouraging people who are actually investing energy into something that they believe is good. Why do that?
Yeah, exactly. No, I mean, if you run a volunteer organization or are part of one, I mean, volunteer relations are extremely important, and they're extremely difficult and challenging because you have a wide range of people who, in a way, you know, don't know each other. They don't know what the skills. So you have to, how do you find a task that is suitable for the person without really knowing the person until later on? And, you know, so there's a bit of, you know, I guess a bit of a marriage that needs to take place, a bit of a dance until you find your most suitable role in an organization that fits your interests, that fits your experience and expertise. So I'm always very, very thankful for our volunteers, you know, whatever it is that they can bring, whether it's staffing during the daytime, helping during events, or taking on a special function. They're all incredibly appreciated and helpful. What you want in your volunteers is ideally that expertise and experience that can take you to the next level. Mm-hmm. So of course we need to wash the floors and you know, do the dishes, and that's great. And there's always a role for that, but you also want those particular skills that will really enrich the organization and take it to the next level, especially when you can't pay those rates or you can't pay people to do that. I mean, so for instance, if you wanted to get a social media kind of champion, I mean, they're being probably paid $60,000-$70,000 in a corporate environment, you know, to make social media work for that organization. Mm-hmm. Well, obviously, you know, that's nowhere where we can be, but that's the kind of person whose skills you'd like them to volunteer. Of course, they're not going to do it for 40 hours a week, but if they could do just 2 hours a week, that would be a huge contribution to someone like Bates Atun.
I'm sorry, Jim, I cut you off. You had you were going to say something.
No.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay. So this might be a good time to bring in our next song. I mean, and music, I was thinking, is another way that people contribute, obviously, to the conversation and to the overall tapestry that we're talking about here. So what is the – can you just talk about the next song that you chose?
Yeah. Well, the next song is very simple. It's called Palestine. It was written and sung by Jim Page, who's an American. And it is part of a CD he released in 2002. It's called Collateral Damage. And the cover of it is basically, you know, Ground Zero and the towers. And I don't think it's coincidental that this song, Palestine, is part of that collection. Because I think Palestine is at the root cause of what ails the world. And I think 9/11, in all its myriad facets and whatever, you know, one can spend, you know, 50 hours speaking about 9/11, it's a symptom of what's wrong with the world and what's making the world sick. And I think Palestine is one of the root causes. And that he chose to sing this song in the middle of this album, you know, says something. And why I chose the song as well is because, you know, in song, he expresses so much of what I can only talk about. And he basically covers all the bases. And he does it beautifully and with heart. And that's what Bates Atun's about. It's not just about words and prose. It's how do you take poetry, how do you take song, how do you take images, like art images, and have them convey feeling that in a way just prose analysis or prose words can't do. They can perhaps bring understanding, they can bring enlightenment or analysis, but they can't bring feeling. And I think for a lot of social justice problems, really feeling is what's going to make the difference. If we do not have compassion, we're not going to solve it. And when I say compassion, I don't mean compassion out of charity. I mean compassion out of recognition that we're all involved. We all have responsibility to resolving it. And charity is not the question. So, for instance, whether it's in Haiti or in Palestine or whatever country, those countries are suffering not from a humanitarian sort of question, but from a political shortcoming that oftentimes is exacerbated by Western powers, whether they be mining companies or military interventions or political machinations. And charity just doesn't do it. It's how do we work with these countries out of compassion and understanding to almost, in a way, release them to their own destinies so that they can be who they need to be. So, for instance, Palestinians aren't asking for charity. They don't want the United Nations to come in or the EU or Canada to give them money. Give us our freedom. Give us sovereignty. We'll solve our own problems. We don't need charity. So it's really not about charity. I mean, I firmly believe that. And I think more and more we're seeing analyses coming out that really show that foreign aid and charity is actually part of the problem. It further extends the conditions that are causing the problems.
Okay, so Palestine by Jim Page.
Oh, well, I'll tell you a story and make it clear as I can about the faraway troubles in the Holy Land. Pictures of the children that's in your mind, laying down their bodies on the firing line. And now the people who live there, and they live under the gun, where it was homeland for 1,000 years before the soldiers come. Surrounded by the armies, airplanes in the sky, everybody knows someone who had to die. Oh, Palestine, there's a hole in your soul. Oh, Palestine, or will it ever be whole? Talk about the settlers that come from so far away, and talk about the money from the USA, and talk about the bullets that are made of plastic and steel, the pictures of a Palestine underneath the Iron Heel. Now what do you do, you know, when they come to your home and they tell you your land is no longer your own? Do you let them take it? Do you dare to resist the pictures of a Palestine underneath the iron fist? Oh, Palestine, there's a hole in your soul. Oh, Palestine, or will it ever be whole? Say we want peace, but we pay for subjugation. We say we want a settlement in terms of occupation. We call for human rights, but we never say what kind. You can see what has come to in the faces of Palestine. Well, does it ever make you think about the friends we endorse? The armies of a general riding on an iron horse. And does it ever make you wonder why it always seems to be such an undemocratic version of democracy? Oh, Palestine, there's a hole in your soul. Oh, Palestine, will it ever be whole? Oh, Palestine, there's a hole in your soul. Oh, Palestine, I'll let your story be told.
Okay, so welcome back to After the Collapse. I'm Louis Moroni. I'm here with Jim Vernon, and we're sitting in Beit Zetun. It's actually, just to say this, it's a beautiful room that you've created here over on Markham Street across from Honest Ed's. We're here with Robert Massoud.
That's right.
Thank you. And and we've been talking about all things Beit Zetun, and we wanted to sort of end the program with or this episode with a discussion of where you see Beit Zetun going from here. What would be, in your wildest dreams, the ultimate goal of what you've started here?
Well, I guess it's longevity. I mean, obviously Beit Zetun has a place, has a role. I mean, that's why it's been adopted by so many communities and individuals and artists as a place where they want to be, where they want to meet people, they want to perform, they want to contribute to. So I guess the real challenge is how to make this, you know, a permanent feature, a place where, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, there could be a Beit Zetun. Because I think there will continue to be, there will always be need for places like Beit Zetun where people can come together and talk about politics and art and culture in a very free and open way. In a very exploratory, unsuppressed kind of get to know each other. What's your problem? What's my problem? How can we help each other? So the way to do that, I think, is to build Beit Zetun in terms of our capacity for excellence, our capacity for professionalism. So that, I think, begins with attracting more volunteers who are proficient in a specialty, like social media, for instance, curation, and then moving that to the point where we can actually hire people, perhaps even on a part-time basis, to fulfill these roles. So right now our budget is really quite tiny. I mean, basically we're covering the rent. I mean, the rent is easily 95% of our cost. And so we can meet that. But in order to go to the next level of having a staff, a professional staff, you know, even part-time, I mean, that might involve, you know, almost doubling our budget. And so that's the step that we need to engage in. So you could say we've gone through our first 3 years. That was the length of our first lease, and we've renewed our lease. And so you could say, you know, we've kind of consolidated, we've basically created the overall feeling of the place. We furnished it. We've set up kind of the, you know, the procedures and how things work. And so it's kind of that phase, that pioneer sort of establishment phase. And now we're in phase two. So phase two begins with our second lease. And I think, you know, it would be a really nice fitting goal to have the second phase be, you know, a next phase of development and professionalization.
Do you see the Beit Zetun philosophy or vision somehow infiltrating our leadership, our government?
No, unfortunately not. Because, I mean, what Beit Zetun stands for is it stands for people. I mean, at its heart, Beit Zetun is about the grassroots. It's about people meeting people. And unfortunately, government and agencies and institutions and bureaucracy, to a large extent, is about power. It's not about people. So it's diametrically opposed. I wish it was different. I wish we could move to, you know, what everybody espouses, which is government for the people, by the people. You know, but I don't know if we've ever been there. So we haven't been there in the last 50 years or 100 years. And we're getting further and further away from that. So
so there won't be a Bates-Attun party.
there won't be a Bates-Attun party as such, but I hope that there will be a Bates-Attun network across Canada. I mean, when people come to Bates-Attun, they say, oh, I wish we had one of these in Montreal. I wish we had one of these in Vancouver. I wish we had one of these in Winnipeg. You know, and it would be lovely. Absolutely. I think every major city on the continent needs a place like this. And there probably are places. They have perhaps different names. They have different focuses, perhaps. But what we need to do is we need to support this kind of infrastructure of independent, unaligned, free organizations, or free, when I say free, I mean free in the sense of unaligned, because we do have to pay the rent, so it can't be free as such. Infrastructure of meeting places and spaces, cultural spaces, where people can build solidarity and mutual understanding. And so I'd love to see, you know, a franchise of Bates-Attuns across the country and into the United States. And of course, I mean, the model is there. We can contribute all kinds of, you know, materials to help people get a start. But of course, nothing sort of beats just firm commitment and endless energy that goes into creating a place like Bates-Attun. So it's a question of finding the people who, you know, who have the time and inclination and the energy. Because believe me, it just takes an enormous amount of time. I mean, we run 10 to 12, 15 events a month sometimes. And so between, you know, conceptualizing the event, talking to the various individuals, planning it, promoting it, implementing it, you know, huge, huge amount of work and time that goes into it. And it's great work. I mean, I personally, I do a lot of it, and I love doing it. It's but if we're going to do that in other places in the country, then we need to have, you know, similar capacities to do the work. And I think it's important to do it professionally. Professionally, as you know, paid people, but even unpaid professionalism, in the sense that it stands on its own merit as quality. It's not just, well, we'll accept it because it's volunteer. No, no, it still has to have a measure of real quality, of real interest, and people got to want it for its own merit, not just because it's free or it's because it's volunteer. And that's the thing behind everything that Zatoun does, to go back to Zatoun, the olive oil, the za'atar, everything that we do has to be beautiful, and it has to be perfect, and it has to be a high quality. Because if it isn't, why should somebody buy it? We don't want people to buy our products out of charity. We want them to buy it because it's damn good olive oil and they love it. Because that's the only way that you can truly create a market and a possibility for the future. If it's built on charity, the charity goes away as soon as the problem goes away. And Palestine, as with Haiti and so many other countries, cannot survive on charity. Charity doesn't work. And I'm not saying charity doesn't work from a, you know, a right-wing perspective. I'm saying it just from a perspective of justice. I mean, if we want true justice, then we have to create the means for people to move forward on their own in honest institutions, in honest frameworks that aren't designed to fail. I believe a lot of what we do as the West, whether it's the United Nations or the EU, we create systems that are designed to create failures. And then we rush in with, you know, on the white horse to rescue them with our humanitarian aid. You know, that model is not one that attracts me at all.
Well, looking around, it's obvious the attention and time that you've put into this place, it looks very professional, but also very Amazing.
It is fantastic olive oil, I have to say.
And the olive oil.
We can't have anything else at
Jim
home.
And I are leaving with some olive oil tonight. So congratulations on phase one. And all the best on phase two. It seems like you're on a great trajectory. I think we just...
Maybe just close by telling us some of the events you have coming up this month.
Yeah, we have a couple of events. We took a break over Christmas. You can't compete with Christmas. Now we're reopening on the 10th of January. That's Thursday. On Friday, our first event will be a report back from Porto Alegre in Brazil. It's the World Social Forum, Free Palestine. And there was 3,500 delegates who met in Porto Alegre to discuss Palestine across BDS movements and other strategies. And a number of people from Toronto traveled there. And they'll be reporting back on their meetings, on their findings. There'll be some video components. And this is on the 11th, which is the Friday, at 7 o'clock. Most of our events begin at 7 o'clock. And the following day is Saturday, 7 o'clock. There is an event. It's a rental. This is a rental event that is put on by the Greater Toronto Workers' Assembly. And they're putting on a series about anti-capitalism and feminism. It also begins at 7 o'clock. Two very polished speakers and academics on that particular topic. And we'll be introducing a lot more of our events as we're coming out of the Christmas New Year period. Look for 10, 12 events a month. They can all be found on our website, baitzatun.org. If you want me to spell that, that's B-E-I-T. Z-A-T-O-U-N.org. We put all our events on the website as current events. If you want to see our past events, they're all there in archives under past events. I've completely lost track of events. I mean, just too many of them, but they're all there.
We'll put a link to your website at facebook.com/afterthecollapse. You've been listening to After the Collapse. We air on radioregent.com. So thank you again, Robert. It was a great pleasure meeting you and learning about what you do here. Jim, Vernon, and myself are here. And if we have time, hopefully, we'll at least hear a bit of the last song that you've chosen, if you could introduce that, and then we'll call it a day up until we get some olive oil from you.
Great. Well, thank you very much. It's been a privilege. And the last song is sung by Reem Bana. And she's a Palestinian singer from the Galilee. And her song is called A Time to Cry. And I guess, again, it's a song that really communicates extremely well. It's a song of lament. And one can, you know, easily get that. And it's about the city of Jerusalem and the occupation and the predicament of a people under occupation, military occupation. And... yeah, I think it speaks for itself just in the tone and the music of it.
Great, thank you.
Thank you very much.
وياسمين تعربش على الحيطان.